Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
My first time I heard this gentleman was about within a year of my recovery, and it was at a Friday night men's meeting down in South Tampa. And if you're not used to that meeting, it's something else. There's a lot of good, strong recovery in that meeting. But there was one person, he didn't speak a lot, but when he did, it made a lot of sense to me. And with that, that gentleman's here tonight and has agreed to speak, Mickey K. Thank you. Time's yours.
All right. Hi, I'm Mickey. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mickey.
Thanks for coming. My sobriety date is August 31st, 1994. My home group is the Friday night men's meeting at Yana. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor people. I haven't done this in a while. I don't like speaking, so if you're listening to this on tape, you might want to turn it off now and get somebody else. But I'm always grateful after I do it, and today it gave me an opportunity to every once in a while sit back and think about my journey. So I'm going to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Just let you know, I've been getting sober or sober for more than half my life. I first came into AA when I was 18 years old. I've been sober since I was 20. So I've been sober for most of my all my adult life, really. But I was, I'm the oldest of six kids, Irish Catholic family, if you wouldn't guess by the six. I grew up mainly in New York. My father, when I was born, he had just gotten out of the Marine Corps. He was a Marine Corps officer, and then he became an FBI agent. So he was pretty much a white glove inspection kind of guy. Loved me to death. But he is a big part of my story because in my head, I was inadequate with him. I wanted one person in the world to think highly of me, and no matter what he said, I felt like he didn't, and that was for as long as I can remember. My parents, in fact, they're still together, loving parents, loving family. We didn't have a ton of money, but we never wanted for anything. Went to, Catholic grammar school, Catholic high school, lived in a nice suburb on Long Island. Just all around good childhood. I was, a smart kid, good in sports, had a ton of friends. For whatever reason, just looking back at it now, it just doesn't make any sense to me that I just always felt like, I ain't giving it off, but just, not part of. If it was, playing basketball as a kid, if I wasn't the MVP, I was a loser. In school, if I wasn't, the top of the class, I was a loser. And I felt that way through everything. If my parents said to my, I have a brother 2 years younger than me, if my mom would have said, oh, you did such a good job, I would have been like, well, what about me? And it was always that way. I always felt like, I had to be number one. And there's a part in the big book, I think when it's Bill's talking about that top of the heap were underneath it, and that was it. I mean, that was me. When I heard that, I was like, oh my God, I get that. I was pretty good in baseball, so I played, I was getting played with a lot of older kids. And then I felt really, really distant because all my friends were playing in the sports younger than me, and I played on this travel team with kids older than me, and I took the spot of one of their friends. So they weren't too happy with me either. But, you know, we go through the season, and I'm always feeling like the outcast and everything else. But we do okay. And I remember we won this really big game, and they invite me to this party afterwards. I really wanted to go. I thought I wouldn't be allowed to go. I was about 11 years old at the time, and they're like 15, 16. My dad says I can go. So I'm like super psyched, and I go to this, you know, getting ready, going to go to this party, and then I get that fear. You know, I'm so scared because I find out there's going to be people, not just the team there, but their friends are going to be there. I'm going to be the only 11-year-old, you know. Right now, 11 sounds really young, but when I was 11, I was a big guy, you know. And, you know, I don't know, I probably put on my Polo cologne or something and go down there. And then I remember, and it was in the basement of somebody's house, and I remember going downstairs, and like the girls are very different from 11 to 15, 16, you know. It was a very exciting time. But I get there, and then all of a sudden it was that thing that, oh my, like, as soon as I was like, I was like, I wish I didn't come. You know, I wanted to leave. I mean, they were looking at me like, you would, like, what is this little kid doing here, you know? And they gave me a drink. And I had, I knew about drinking. I mean, my dad doesn't drink a lot. My mom, she likes to drink. But my dad never drank. And my father, like I said, I mean, he was a straight guy. And, you know, we talked about grades, we talked about school, you know, we talked about sports, we talked about, like, you know, excelling in everything. And I didn't view him as a fun guy, except when he drank. When he drank, he was different. When he drank, he'd say, you know, come sit on my lap and give me a hug and all this other stuff. So I saw drinking as a good thing. So when someone offered me a drink, I was like, sweet, then I'll be that guy. And I drank it. I drank it as fast as I could, and I asked for another one. And I don't know how many I drank. And I'm not sure if it was on the first drink or the second drink or the third drink. But on one of those drinks, something happened. And I remember the feeling. I remember, you know, chugging the beer, because I knew if you chugged it, that was, you know, you didn't have to taste it so much and you'd get the effect better. And I was drinking for effect. And I felt that feeling. That feeling that, you know, it was, you know, the tan, they call it the Irish tan where I'm from, but, you know, it's the tan from the inside out, where it's like the warmth started to go up my cheeks, and, you know, and this, the all over, like, just feeling, it was a spiritual experience. It was just like, I felt fantastic. And then when I looked around, you guys felt fantastic about me. I mean, these girls were checking me out. You know, it was like everyone wanted the 11-year-old, I'm telling you. And the guys were like glad I was there. And it was a life-changing experience. And I just, I don't really, I'm not saying I blacked out, I just don't really remember much of that night. I do know, like, I remember them dropping me off in front of my house, and my pants kept on falling down. I guess I couldn't button my pants or something, but I had toothpaste in my hair, and, you know, they rang the doorbell and leaned me against the thing, and my parents opened the door, and I fell right in. And at 11, you know, my dad thought it was cute. You know, it was nice, it was funny, it was blah, blah, don't ever do it again, probably yelled at me, but no big thing. And from then on, I was part of that team. You know, that they liked me, and I felt comfortable. And I didn't drink, you know, every day from, you know, that point on, but I knew that feeling, and I knew what made me feel a part of. So I began, when I could, to drink. I would practice drinking, because they played drinking games. So, you know, I would go home, and, you know, I would take a beer from the fridge, and, you know, go into the shower, and I'd chug it, you know, or I'd, you know, I forget what you call it now, when you put the key in it and pop it, you know, and shotgun, you know. And so I'm 11 years old, and I'm drinking alone in the shower. I just, you know, I knew that drinking was the thing that made me feel good, and drinking was the thing that made everyone else feel good about me. So, you know, from that point on, you know, from, I guess, for the rest of grammar school, drinking was okay. You know, I would do that. A lot of times I would, you know, I delivered papers, so I had a little bicycle, and I would ride my bicycle up to, you know, the deli or this beer distributor, and I'd wait outside for people going in. I'd have, like, my $5, ask them to buy me a six-pack, and, you know, and I'd drink whenever I could. By eighth grade, and it sounds so silly now saying that, but by eighth grade, I was drinking every weekend, at least once, you know, probably twice a weekend. Sometimes I would, you know, come home, like I lived down the block from my school. I'd come home from school, and if my mom wasn't home, she was a stay-at-home mom, I would drink at home during lunchtime, just practicing, trying to build up my tolerance for the party. And you know, and I felt like a big guy. You know, I felt like a man because most of the other 12, 13-year-old kids weren't drinking. You know, I was, and I'm hanging out with these older kids, and life is fantastic. And then I'm going to high school, and I go to this all-boys Catholic high school that I did not want to go to. I wanted to go to this other school that had that was co-ed, a lot of my friends were going to. But this was like, you know, the school on Long Island. So, you know, my dad wants me to go. So my dad wants me to do it. I want to make my dad happy, so I go. On top of it, my dad, you know, we discuss, you know, you have to take a language in school. And I'd taken 2 years of French, and I didn't like French. And my dad says, you know, you should take German. And, you know, German would be great for banking. Take German. Okay, dad wants me to take German, so I take German. So I'm drinking now at least 3 times a week, 4 times a week, at least, you know, one night during the week, whatever. And I remember for my freshman, you know, orientation, I get like 2 other kids, and we get like totally hammered going to the school. And I don't know how we didn't get kicked out because we were just beyond belief. But I do this thing, and I do really well in sports. I go to the school, and I'm taking German. I'm a straight A student. Okay, I don't have to try real hard to do it. I just get A's, you know. But my A's, I have to be like number one. And so my German class is problematic because I'm the only kid in my class who hadn't lived in Germany. My German teacher, he's like, you know, thinks he's a college professor or something. He doesn't speak a lick of English in class. And I remember we get, you know, the first progress report or whatever. And I have a B in German. I had never seen a B before in my life. And my father was not happy with me having a B. And I had worked pretty hard in this class. So I remember this because he took me outside and we sat in the... At the time, we had a van, and sit in the van, and he talks to me about my B. And we talk for a good period of time about my B and how I have to try harder and work harder, and that he's going to get a tutor for me for a B. And I remember sitting there, and I said, I'm done. You know, I just made a decision. I'm done. I'm done trying. I'm done trying to please you. I worked really hard. I took this class because of you. You know, all this stuff. And it was all at him. And I just stopped. You know, I just stopped trying. From that point on, freshman in high school, I'm drinking pretty much every day. I'm in school. It was a jacket and tie kind of place. I'm creative. I get a flask. I get some tubing. I sit in class with a sicken on it. You know, I'm just having a blast, you know, and I'm getting by. And I go from, you know, all A's and a B to, you know, I don't know what I was getting, C's, you know, and I'm getting in trouble. My dad's not afraid to, you know, yell at me, ground me. I get grounded at the time with work. He was traveling a lot. I sneak out of the house. I start doing, you know, anything else I get my hands on. I live in Nassau County, which, you know, if I'm on the border of Nassau, which is, like, nice and, you know, grass and all of those stuff, and then Queens, which is part of the city. And there's like this street, you know, Jericho Turnpike, where we cross this line, it becomes Jamaica Avenue. And it's very different in Jamaica Avenue versus Jericho Turnpike. And you can get, you know, all kinds of things on Jamaica Avenue. And so I started going to Jamaica Avenue a lot. And I'm a 13-year-old little white kid on a bike, you know, and I'm riding to places I just don't belong. And I have a wise mouth, and people say things to me, and I say things back, and I get beat up a lot. Because I could run and pedal real fast, but when you're hammered, you know, your foot slips off the bike, you fall down, bad things happen. So anyway, I start going to the hospital a lot, and my dad is getting upset with me, he's getting worried, we start sending all this stuff, my grades fall completely, my sports, you know, coaches are calling my dad saying, you know, your son forgot to show up to practice for the past week, you know, and my dad would go to a game, and games were like, you know, basketball, I remember basketball games were at like 5:30, and we get out of class at 3, so that's like 2.5 hours, you know, and so I got drunk, you know, and I'd miss the bus, and my dad would be like, go to a game, and be like, you know, where's my son, and the coach would be like, yeah, he didn't miss the bus. So I was getting in trouble for that kind of stuff. And then I found out that if I snuck out after my parents went to bed, I could, you know, walk up to the train station. I forget about Jamaica Avenue. I could get on the train and go into Manhattan. And there was all kinds of crazy things in Manhattan. So I'm like 14, 15 years old on a Wednesday night going into Manhattan and hanging out from like 11 to hopefully 5 in the morning so I could get home in time for my parents to get up, which I would miss a lot of the times. And I remember always, you know, walking down, you know, seeing my dad's car, thinking, oh, this is going to be bad. So I was perpetually grounded from the time I was, like, you know, 13 years old until I went to treatment. But what happened was I became problematic to my family. You know, my father would, very frustrated with me, say, you know, You need to stop this because, you know, one, you're killing yourself. Two, you're killing, you know, your mother. You're killing me and your brother and our 4 sisters. You know, this is just not good for the family. And so I would get kicked out of the house. They let me back in. I ended up getting beat up really bad by an off-duty cop. And I took that as, you know, and I ran with it as, you should be sympathetic for me. And, you know, I remember claiming I had PTSD. It sounded like a good thing. Some psychiatrist said I should have it. So I was like, okay, I got it. And that became the reason for everything that I did. And it turns out I remember my dad saying to me that, you know, if you continue down this path, you're not going to be welcome here anymore. I had that when I got beat up, I couldn't play sports for a year because of my injuries, and I pretty much lost all opportunities for scholarships, except there was one school in, you know, that was willing to give me a partial scholarship. And my father said that, you know, if I didn't mess up anymore, that he would, you know, pay for the other part of it. But if I messed up one more time, then I would have to send a letter to the school declining their offer. And I was like a senior, and the only thing I wanted to do was get out of the house. I was like, once I got to college, I would be okay. Then I could just, you know, drink like I want to, and no one would bother me. That night, you know, I forgot to come home. And so, you know, the next day, I find a letter to this school. I'm not coming. Probably like within a week, my dad says, you know, one more time, you're out of the house for good. That night, you know, it was like there was no long period of time where I was doing good. I got kicked out. I came home, you know, a few hours past curfew, and my dad said, you know, you don't live here anymore. I went and stayed at a friend's house. They were nice enough to let me stay with them. And I stole from them. I stole from them, and I got kicked out of their house. And then I tried to go back home, and my dad was like, no, you don't live here. So I was like, this is it. This is perfect. I'm free. You know, I don't have any more responsibility. You kick me out. I don't have to go to school. I don't have to do anything. I'm going to move into Manhattan. I'm going to make it. Things are going to be fantastic. So, you know, I'm either 17 or 18 at this point, and I go to Manhattan. You know, I take the train. I go in. I was very familiar with Manhattan at the time, or I thought I was, you know, big 18-year-old, and I knew some people, and I was like, I get an apartment, but let me celebrate my newfound freedom. So I got hammered, and I slept with some people who sleep outside, you know, and slept in a little courtyard, and I hung out with these people a lot because they never asked, you know, you for anything, really, some share some stuff with them, and they were pretty free spirits, so we slept in this courtyard, and they taught me the tricks, like take off your shoes and put them in your hands so no one comes and steals them. But what happens was, like, if someone, you're sleeping in a courtyard where people sleep in an apartment, and then when they come out, they don't want to see people in their courtyard, so they have other people who come up and either hit you with a broom or shoot you with a hose, you know, to get you out of there. So that was not a good way to wake up. I wasn't happy about that. But I remember that first morning because I woke up, you know, that was a broom, and I put, you know, my shoes back on, and I thought, oh my God, I've hung out with these guys before, but like, I'm sleeping on the street. You know, this is just not cool. And I was like, what do I do? I was like, I can't go home. I had no skills. I couldn't get a job. And they were going to beg for money. So that's what I did. And I was still a little buzzed, so it was okay. I start begging for money. And I made a fortune. You know, I mean, I made money fast. You know, they just gave me tons of money. I told them I got, you know, mugged last night, and I'm trying to get back home, and, you know, I look like I got mugged last night, and so I get all this money, and I just go and get hammered again. I slept, you know, in the same courtyard, and I woke up, and I thought I'll do it again. The place was, it was like right out where they get out of, near Penn Station to go to work. So I went back to that same place thinking, I did real good yesterday, I'm going to do it again. And I think it was the same, you know, that day, some guy who I didn't remember, but he remembered me, you know, and he was like, you know, you were just here yesterday with that same story, you know, I'm not giving you any money, you're lying. And he said some things, and I felt a little bad, like he was a little abrupt with me, but I went and did my thing. And I do this, and to be honest, I can't tell you if it was one day. I know it was more than one day. It might have been 2 days. It might have been a week. It wasn't a long time. I mean, God bless the people who live on the streets for a long period of time. That wasn't me. You know, I was great when I was drunk. I hated it when I was not drunk. You know, I don't think I was ever sober, but there was times I was not drunk, and I felt really bad, and I felt disgusting. And I remember there was one night where it rained, and I went to go into the subway to sleep, and they had wooden benches up there with little, they're not like armrests, but the little rivets to separate the seats, and I think they do them to make them real uncomfortable for people to sleep on. So I tried to get comfortable, and I remember a cop came by and hit me with a nightstick and told me, you know, there's no bums sleeping in the subway. I was like, you don't understand, I'm not a bum, you know, I'm Mickey, you know. I'm from Long Island, you know. And he said, he was like, you're drunk, you smell, you're dirty, and you're sleeping in the subway. You're a bum. And I was very, you know, I was like, you don't know me. And but I go and I go out into the rain, and God bless my father. Within probably 24 hours of that period, he comes by and, like, literally drives up. I'm walking down the street, and it's an early morning, so I'm not drunk, I'm not sober, but I'm feeling like a loser. And he pulls up, and he asks me if I want to go for breakfast. And my thought was, finally learned his lesson. He wants me to come home. I get in the car with him. We go to this diner, and he's talking. I have no idea what he's saying. But he finally says those magic words, you know, you want to come home? Yes. You know, so I go home. Well, apparently what he said before that was, you know, you can come home on the condition that, you know, you go back to your therapist, because I'd seen a bunch of therapists, and you go to AA every day, and you go back to school. So I go home, I take a shower, one of the best showers of my life, and I get in a bed, I think I'm going to sleep. I might have fallen asleep for, I guess I fell asleep for a while, because that was morning. Nighttime, two guys come into my room, literally drag me out of bed, throw some clothes at me, bring me out, put me in a car, and take me to an AA meeting. And it was at Belmont Racetrack, at this little house. And I knew Belmont Racetrack. I used to get drunk with the guys who worked at Belmont Racetrack. And I go up into this room, and it's this little house upstairs. And one of my baseball coaches was there. One of my father's friends was there. One of my friend's fathers was there. And I was like, oh, my God. And they're like, say this, that thing that, you know, people say, save the seat for you. We've been waiting for you. And I'm like, oh, my God, what's going on? And then there was this guy who sat at the front, kind of like this, and he was wearing a white lab coat. And the only thing I could think of was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and this is bad news, and bad things are going to happen, and oh, my God, what's going on? And I could tell you, today he was like, he just became a phlebotomist, and he was showing off his lab coat, and, you know, and all those guys were in AA, and so I started going to AA. And I got to tell you, from that first meeting, I don't remember anything else other than that. I didn't know there were steps on the wall. I didn't know what people said. They didn't do white chips up there. They did give me coffee. I'm a shaker. I shook the coffee all over. They didn't give me any more coffee. And then they were talking about, you know, what to do after, and I knew there was a liquor store around the corner, so when the meeting got out, I took off. I went to the liquor store. I got drunk. I went home. For the next couple months, I went to AA every day. I went to AA every day, I went to school every day, and I drank just about every day. People in AA asked me not to drink before the meetings, so I would try not to drink before the meetings. I started to go to earlier meetings, but I'd not drink before the meetings. What happened was what people in AA were saying somehow infiltrated my mind. I could buy the fact that someday I would grow up to be an alcoholic. But I did not want to be one now. What I wanted was the 10 to 15 years of drinking that everyone else got. You know, I wanted, you know, the DUI. You know, I got kicked out of driver's ed for drinking and driving. You know, it's like I hadn't even had the chance. And, you know, I wanted, in my head, like as sick as it sounds, but it's like I wanted the divorce. I wanted, you know, all those things. It was like, I mean, I was 18 years old, living on the streets. It's not like someone's going to marry me anytime soon. It was just like, you know, I just felt like I missed something, and I wanted it. So I thought I could use AA to control my drinking, and so that's what I started to try and do. If I could, you know, not drink between meetings and only drink on, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you know, and so I try to put like a day together and 2 days together. And I would always celebrate, you know, when I met that goal, you know, I'm not going to drink for a day. And then the next day, woohoo, you know, I didn't drink that day in 2 days. And what happened was I had this, I wasn't going to drink on the 4th of July. It was in my 3-day period or something. I wasn't willing to change people, places, and things. So I'm still hanging out with all my friends. We're going to the beach for the 4th of July, and we stop at the beer distributor to go to the beach. And all my friends are very supportive of me not drinking. And they asked, do you want anything? And I was like, no. And then I thought, in my head, I thought, you know what, it's just beer. Beer would be okay. And I'll just get a six pack and I'll be fine. So I get the six pack. One thing, you know, once we start, you go off. So next thing you know, it's 2:00 in the morning, and I'm on Jamaica Avenue, and I'm looking for things to enhance my beer. And the guy that usually I get stuff from, you know, he was all out on the 4th of July. So he says, come with me, we can go somewhere else. And I grab my friend, because I got kicked out of driver's ed, I don't have a car. So we get him, we put him in the car, and we go to a place called East Jamaica. And I don't belong at East Jamaica at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's 2 o'clock in the morning, and we go into this thing. One thing leads to another. There's guns. There's people pointing. There's yelling. There's this guy threatening my life if I don't give him my money. And I have this thing when I have to have it, I have to have it. And you can threaten to kill me, and I don't care. And I told him that. And so then he put the gun on my friend, and I kind of laughed. I was like, you know, I'm going to give it to you for me. I'm not going to give it to you for him. He's not my friend anymore. We end up stopping at this place, and he says to me, those people have what you want, but they want to kill me, so I can't get it. So I'll get it. So I get out of the car and go walking up to these people. And they say things to me to let me know that I should not continue walking. But they have what I want, so I'm going to keep going. And I say things back that I shouldn't have said. They had guns, so they start hitting me with these guns. And then I kind of, you know, when it's that first hit, you kind of sober up, and I think, don't go down. Just don't go down. And I start running, and they started shooting. And I started praying, because I always believed in God, and I prayed a lot. So I'm running and praying, and I don't really think, to be honest, they're shooting at me. I think they're just kind of shooting and laughing and whatnot. But at the time, I was pretty scared. So I turn the corner, and I think, I know where I can go. And I just left my friends with that other guy. I got in the subway. I went to the city. My jaw was broken in 4 spots. My eye socket was fractured. My head was split open. And I wound up in the hospital. And I come to, and I start thinking about what happened. And I think, I might have a problem. You know, there's something wrong that I didn't take the time out to say, you know, thanks for getting me out of that one, God. And I'm still going to do what I do. And so I asked my parents, who had offered for me to go to treatment. I asked to go to treatment. And I went to Father Martin's Ashley in Maryland. My jaw was wired shut, so I didn't have to talk. But, you know, I was sober for 30 days. I got out. I went back to AA. I got a sponsor. He had 60 days, but he was the only other young guy in the room. He had what I wanted. He had 60 days. I had 30 days. He didn't have a sponsor, so I became his sponsor. So I was giving it away. And we drank together on my 90th day. And I actually came to back in that treatment center again. That time I stayed 45 days in the 30-day program. And I went to Turning Point of Tampa. It saved my life. Because I became involved in AA. It kind of forced me to deal with certain issues that I've been unwilling to deal with. It forced me to go to meetings all the time and reach out to people. It forced me to, you know, talk more than just, hey, I'm fine, everything's okay. It forced me to feel. And, I do 7 months in the 6-month program, and I never coined out. But I became like, you know, I'm a slow learner, but I made friends, you know, I had all this stuff. I had, you know, things were looking good. And I was willing to do 90% of the program. I thought there were some things that really weren't necessary for me because I was young and, I was different. The sponsorship thing didn't work so well for me. So I just became my own sponsor. I used the group as a sponsor, that kind of stuff. And when I had about 13 months, I decided that I needed a change. And I moved to Boca. And I also decided that it would be really good for one of my, you know, best friends growing up, for him to move down with me. And so we got an apartment together. And we went to Hooters. And I've been sober now for 13 months. And I went to an AA meeting down there, and I didn't like it. It wasn't any good. But I was going to school now. I had a job. Things were turning around. And I'm sitting at Hooters with my friends, and I'm feeling pretty grown up, and I'm like, you know, I'm 20 years old now. I've dealt with a lot of issues in the three treatment centers that I've been to. Hooters only serves beer. How big can you get in trouble with a beer? So I have a beer. And that night, I leave my friend at Hooters, I guess, and I'm looking for Jamaica Avenue, you know? There's no Jamaica Avenue in Boca. And I get lost. I'm trying to cut through someone's yard to get back to Hooters because I realize I can't find Jamaica Avenue. And I fall in somebody's pool. I go and I ring this guy's doorbell. It's probably 11 o'clock at night. And I ask the guy for directions to Hooters. And it was a big house. And I'm drunk. I'm soaking wet. The guy looks at me. And, you know, he tells me to, you know, get off his lawn. And I know that look. You know, I've seen that look before. And I think, well, I'm a wise guy. Push it. Well, you got a beer and a cigarette. And he didn't find it humorous. And he said some other things to me. And then he watched me walk off his lawn. And I felt him the whole time. It was the biggest lawn I've ever been on. And I knew that look, and I felt it. It was the same look the cop gave me, you know, with the nightstick. It was the same look that guy gave me outside of Penn Station, calling me like a bum and a thief. But this time I knew he was right. You know, this time there was no defense. I felt it. And I decided, you know, that I can't do this anymore. And for the next week, I tried to get back to Tampa, and I couldn't do it. I would start out to Tampa, and I would get, you know, to a certain period of drive for an hour or two, and I'd have to stop and get a drink. And it was just, and I just couldn't do it. I couldn't picture my life drinking, and I couldn't picture my life sober. I felt so bad sober, and I didn't think it would ever go away. And I didn't believe that the steps and God would make it go away. It just sounded so ridiculous to me that, you know, this God is going to make me feel better. I mean, I wanted him to get people to stop shooting me, but, you know, but to make me feel better, but what else was I going to do? So I end up, you know, talking to my parents. They let me move back home. I move into their basement. I get a job cleaning ashtrays at a hotel. I go, I get a sponsor, I say, please help me, I'll do whatever it takes. He takes me through the steps. I wanted to drink every day. I woke up in the morning, it was the first thing I thought about. He made, you know, little tricks for me, like he would say, like in the morning when I would wake up, I would, you know, I'd pray, and I'd write something out on an index card from the big book. So when I started thinking about drinking, because I'm obsessive. When I think about it, I think about it, I think about it, I think about it, and eventually I'm going to do it. And so he told me you can't think about something and memorize something at the same time. So I would have like an index card with a preamble, or I'd have an index card with the 12 steps, or like some paragraph out. And so I would, you know, when I would clean up my ashtrays, you know, I'd be walking around memorizing it so I would stop thinking. I went to a meeting in the morning before work. I went to a meeting at noon. And then when I got off the train, I walked straight to a meeting and went to one or two meetings at night. And I did that for about 6 months. And one day a week, I'd get with my sponsor, and we'd do step work. And, you know, on weekends, you know, we'd get up early in the morning, and he'd drive me to an institution meeting, you know. You know, I became involved in AA. I remember he made me be the greeter, which was like the scariest thing in the world, but then became the greatest thing in the world. You know, I wanted to be the coffee maker. They wouldn't let me at first. You know, they said I could be the assistant coffee maker. Basically, you just have to show up at the same time the coffee maker and do what the coffee maker says to do. But, you know, but I became a part of, and I started to feel better. You know, I still didn't have a relationship with God, but I worked on having a relationship with God. I didn't think he was going to solve all my problems, but I believed that you believed he was going to solve all my problems. And I did believe that my way would not work. I knew that if I went back to drinking, that bad things would happen, that I would hurt, that I would hurt everyone around me, and that I probably wouldn't die. You know, if I would have thought that I would have died, I probably would have done it at that time. But I knew that, I just believed I would live a miserable existence. So I do all this stuff, and I go through the steps, and I'm feeling better. And my sponsor sits me down one time, and he's like, you know, you're doing really good. You can start making some of your own decisions. And I'm like psyched about that. And I have my day off from cleaning ashtrays, and I'm sitting downstairs and watching TV, and I'm thinking about, you know, I clean ashtrays, you know. My brother's, you know, going to school. My sister's going to school. Everyone's going to school. I want to go to school. My dad says, I've paid for 3 treatment centers. You're not going to school. See that commercial. Be all you can be. We'll pay for school. So I have a license now. So I get in my car, and I have 6 months sober. I drive down to the recruiter station, and I think, you know, my dad was a Marine, and he used to talk about the different branches. And I think Air Force, because that's pretty easy. So I go to the Air Force. No offense to any Air Force people. But so I go to the Air Force, and I'm working an honest program. So when they ask you those questions, have you tried this? I say, yes. So we get through a number of them, and she says, you can leave. So I'll go back to impress my father. Let me go to the Marine Corps, because in New York, they're all together. So I go to the Marine Corps, and the guy says, that's all right. Well, you got 6 months now. When you get a year, you could get a waiver. Well, I'm impulsive. I want to do it. I want to do it today. So I go next door. I go to the Army. And they go, don't worry about it. Just lie. Cool. We're in. Sign the papers. Go to my meeting that night. I go, hey, guess what I did? My sponsor's like, are you kidding me? Didn't you learn anything? You talked to your sponsor about these things? I was like, you said I could start making some of my own decisions. I meant if you wanted to mix up a meeting or something, but come on. So, I go to basic training, and I had about, I don't know, seven months sober. I go to basic training, and so here I am. I'm not drinking, I'm not smoking, I'm not going to meetings. I am so freaking angry. So I did pretty good in basic training, and I did so I do good, and I go to this other thing, and I get out of the school, and I think I want to go back to Tampa. I'm tired in New York. I want to go back to Tampa. I love Tampa AA. I love my friends and everything else. Let me do it. So I come back to Tampa. I get a job. I get enrolled in school. I join the reserves, not regular army. I go to my first weekend drill, you know, and they playing this joke on the new guy. Hey, we're getting deployed. We're going to Haiti. I was like, we never go anywhere. They're like, no, really, we're getting deployed. We're going to Haiti. I was like, seriously? We did. We went deployed. We went to Haiti. So now I have, I don't know, a year sober, maybe 13 months sober, and I go to Haiti. And there's no AA meetings. I've been through the steps. I got a new sponsor when I went to Tampa again, and I wanted to stay sober. I didn't know how I was going to do it because they were drinking there. I wanted to drink, but I really wanted to stay sober. And so I started to do this thing where I started to develop a relationship with God. I started to pray like I've never prayed before. I started to, I would have meetings by myself in the chaplain's tent. And I would, you know, ask God for, you know, help. And then I would, like, seriously sit by myself in the chaplain's tent and open up the big book, and I'd read the preamble out loud, and I'd read how it works. And I'd ask if anyone has a topic, and I'd say, oh, I have a topic. And you know, and I would share out loud, and I would ask, and I would pretend like what my sponsor would say or what, you know, somebody else would say. And things happened. You know, things happened. I remembered things that people said that I would never remember, you know. And I felt this thing like that God was with me, and it was going to be okay. And he was. And that thing they talk about in the second step, when you, you know, flip on the light switch and you know that the lights are going to come on, that became my relationship with my higher power, and it was fantastic. It was probably some of the best spiritual times of my life. And then I came back and I took credit for it all. you know, I stayed sober, you know, and I got miserable real fast. I was fortunate that I didn't have to drink, and I got back into it, and I started, you know, working these things and getting back into the program, and I went to school, and I had a great relationship, and I had friends, and I started sponsoring people, and I went back to, you know, getting a commitment and getting a home group and taking meetings to the jails and doing all these things, and life started to get better, and I started to grow up. I found out I did well in school when I showed up and I was sober. So I went to, you know, I decided, well, I'm getting ready to graduate college. What do I do now? Well, I want to, you know, pick a profession. Let me see if I can do it. You know, instead of before saying, oh, no, that's too hard, I'll fail, I tried. You know, and so I did, and I moved to Gainesville to go to another school. And when I was there, I made a commitment that, one, I was going to do it in Gainesville and not somewhere else, so I can choose what things are important to me, and I can have relationships with people that are important to me, and I cannot make, you know, money the most important thing or prestige or anything else. And I decided that, you know, I was going to come back to Tampa every weekend when, you know, part of me was like, well, you know, people I'm quote-unquote competing with, they're spending their weekends up there and working harder, and but I was like, you know, this is what's important, and I came back, and I had a great experience. And I'll tell you, I went to, I'm getting towards the end of this, you know, and at this time, I mean, I worked really hard, and I was a struggling student, I ate a lot of peanut butter and jelly, you know, and all this stuff, and I'm getting towards the end, and, like, I have job offers, and my ego's feeling a little good, and all this stuff, and, you know, I'm in a relationship, and we had these conversations about what's important and what my future looked like, and I decided I was going to take this job that would probably pay less money, but it would give me more free time. But I was finally going to make money, you know. I would finally, like, eat steak when I want to eat steak. And I still love peanut butter and jelly, though. But, you know, and then I get this call, and I remember I'm about to go to the basketball game for Florida's playing Kentucky, and it's it's February 7th, 2003, and I get this call, and it's like an Army guy, and he was like, you know, you're activated, you know, report for duty within 24 hours, and I was like, what? I'm not in the Army. Yeah, you got a week left on your contract, you know, and so, yeah, that's what I said. So, but, you know, and my first thing was, I remember the night, you know, I prayed, and for some reason I started packing my apartment, but I prayed, and I'm like, you know, well, God's going to take care of me. And I really believe that. Like, I don't know why this is happening. I really don't think it's very fair, but I'm sure there's a reason, and it's going to be okay. And, you know, do a thing, and I go, and I went, you know, over to Kuwait and Iraq. And I had, you know, I struggled at times, but it was, again, it gave me the opportunity to have that relationship with God, because when these other things aren't there, I depend on God. And when I depend on God, God is there. When TV's there, or wife's there, or something else, I don't depend on God. But I depend on God, and God is there. And I had some fantastic experiences. That I'm so grateful for, and I met people that, you know, I never would have met, and I saw things I never would have got the opportunity to see. So I'm like thrilled to death that that happened. And then, well, you never want to go over. That's the worst thing a speaker could do. I tell you that. But but you know, it was another one of those times in my life where I thought God wasn't being fair. And I've thought that before, and it was another one of those times where I thought I was getting, you know, I was getting screwed. And it was like something bad was happening. But now that it's over, you know, I look back and it's like, thank you. You know, and I try to remember that when I think I'm getting screwed. Because most of the times, like, when I knew that I had to go to AA, I thought I was getting screwed. You know, when I got deployed to Haiti, I thought I was getting screwed. When I think I'm getting screwed, God is taking care of me. You know, it just usually takes me a while to see it. Because those are those times where it's just, I look back, and that's what I remember. I don't remember, you know, that Thursday night when I, you know, sat home and watched TV all night. I don't know what night that was, you know, but those experiences I remember and they become a part of me. And so I come back and I got a job, and things just started, you know, falling in my lap. I have a wonderful relationship who was with me this whole time, and she's sober. She finally said, well, we finally got married, you know, and we had our families together, and we just did that this last year, and it was absolutely the most incredible experience. Wish I would have done it earlier, but I absolutely loved it. We went on a honeymoon that, you know, beyond my comprehension, and I'm just having, like, the most incredible life that I never would have had I not been sober. That I never would have had I not stayed sober, and that I never would have had I not developed a relationship with God. And I'll be the first to tell you, I take it for granted. You know, I should, as I sit here and think about it, I am so unbelievably blessed. I mean, it's absolutely incredible. I'm a kid who's sleeping on the streets, you know, and I have a life beyond anything I could ever have imagined, that I certainly, you know, don't deserve. It's all, you know, God's grace. But I show up, you know, I show up when the phone rings, I answer it. You know, when someone asks me to speak, I come. I'm not very good at it, but I call my sponsor, you know, and I have a core group of meetings I go to, and I'm so blessed to have sponsees in my life. You know, and I'm so blessed to have a beautiful wife and, you know, some beautiful kids. And it's just, the most incredible thing in the world. And I did not know that when I first came into AA. So that's all I got. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.